But eventually, it came to be, we moved from place to place in England, and we went from our first location in Malvern to down to Bristol, and then we went up to a place called Hoy Lake near Liverpool, where we trained to go across. So we were sitting up there in Hoy Lake, which is just outside of Liverpool, when D-Day occurred. When that occurred, we knew that we had a colonel in our outfit that was determined to take our hospital. I was in a hospital group at this point. He was determined that this hospital group would go to France. And I always remember there was a popular song that they called Pistol Pack and Mama. And we had a guy in our outfit that made a parody of that song. Our colonel's name is Danny. And so
Al Dexter?
The parody went sort of, Channel Hoppin' Danny, we don't want to go to France and Channel Hoppin' Tubbs, we just want to stay right here and drink up all the pubs. And that was how he wrote this. And then it, of course, went Channel Hoppin' Danny, lay that bedpan down, Channel Hoppin' Danny. The funny thing was, that this guy was one of my buddies. We kind of wrote the song in a pub one night. We had a bivouac just before we went to France. And we all got up, the officers, man, enlisted them. The hospital has a lot of nurses and officers and people connected to it. And we had a night's entertainment. So somebody said to this guy, Hank, get up and sing your song. So Hank had to get up in front of the hall. The officers, had the colonel, Danny, and everybody else to sing his song. Well, it brought the house down. But, so we did go to France. We crossed to Normandy about a month after D-Day. And things had quieted down a little bit. They weren't quite normal yet, but they quieted down. And we were followed by AFN, who set up a high-powered station in Normandy. And then another station opened up at the time, which was, they called ABSI, which was in England, southeast coast of England, ABSIE, American Broadcasting Service in Europe. And ABSI was broadcasting more or less propaganda programs in various languages to the Germans, the French, and so forth. And the BBC was also set up in a meeting way, broadcasting into France and Germany. And the interesting thing when you heard the BBC broadcasting into France was the code messages they gave in English. You would hear like the small brown squirrel jumped over the fence. You know, hear these silly things going on. Well, these were all messages in code to the underground people and the folks over in France and Belgium who were waiting for word that, you know, they could do whatever they had to do. So we used to hear all these programs. So we moved from France up into Belgium, and up in Belgium, we settled down for a while in a town called Liège, which is in the eastern part, French-speaking town. One of my biggest thrills was we had a radio. We always have a radio somewhere in that area. It was tuning the radio and getting an ID on a station. Now, you know how John likes to get IDs. Well, in Europe, they don't have call letters. They ID in different ways, but I tuned the radio and I got this EC Liège Radio Diffuso National Bells. I said, gosh, that's the Liège station I got, EC Liège. So that was a thrill to hearing that. We also used to listen to Radio Luxembourg over there. They play a lot of good American stuff. But we also heard the Germans that were over there in Cologne still with their Hitler stuff, and that was sort of scary when you hear all these stations so close. Cologne is only 100 or so miles from where we were. We were in Belgium when the Battle of the Bulge began. In fact, I had the Battle of the Bulge several years ago. I've been cutting down my diet since then. But we had the Battle of the Bulge, and they came within 14 miles of Liège. And what happened actually was, though, that I was working in the PX for this hospital outfit, and they decided that I was expendable. I mean, they didn't need me in the PX, and they were losing a lot of frontline medics. So, I know they put some guys out to go, and I got sent out of the outfit to give me a frontline job as a combat medic. And so I went down and joined the 36th Division, which is a Texas division. half the old Texan guys are dead because they've been killed in Salerno or a place in Italy and so on, southern France and the Vosges Mountains. So they need a lot of replacements, so I wound up there. And the rest of the war, this is several months in 1945. I spent with the 36th moving across France and across Germany. And I'll say everywhere we went, when we got into Germany, we would take over a house. But being a medic didn't mean you couldn't carry a gun or anything, but you had to stay with the infantry people. You had to be with them. We always immediately went and found a house we liked, and if people didn't like it, we told them to get out. The Germans. We always found a nice radio, too. And I mean, these radios are there. They were not just your little table model things. They were big, puzzles. And all the radio stations over there, the radios had all the settings on the dial printed on there. They had the name, like Radio Luxembourg, and all the French and English and German stations, where you could tell by just who they ended up, what station you were listening to. So we always did well with the radio. So the war came to an end, and I got through it all right. And we wound up in Germany as an army and occupation outfit. And we settled down in a little town called Blaubeuren, which we were still medics, and we ran a company A station there. We didn't have much to do. And we picked a house. In one house, we had our company A station, and we had our quarters. Of course, the third floor was operated by Polish girls who worked for us. I mean, DPs, you know, displaced people. Yeah. Across the little driveway sort of place was the main house. Beautiful big house. And the Germans, well, I forget where they went, they kicked them out. This is after war, but you know, they had to go somewhere. Anyway, they had a beautiful radio, the best radio yet. And in a great big room, which we used as our day room, we had parties there, we played poker and all those things we had. But I said, I have plenty of time to do radio listening. And I don't know what kind of radio it was now. You guys might know the name of German radios, I don't. But it was connected to an antenna on the roof. And believe me, you could sit there and you could get all of Europe in the daytime. And at night you could get, well, you know, you could hear, I'm trying to think how far we get. We got less, I compiled a log book there. This isn't it, this is what I made from it. I took radio programs from the local newspapers, and in the French, and in the German, and the British newspapers, they had programs for radio stations. And I took them all out of sighting, that's all I could say. We didn't have any feeling of doomsday or anything like that. We knew we'd win the war.
We heard it at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. On a Sunday, it was a football game, and they broke in. And the question in my family was, "Where's Pearl Harbor? What's that?"
Now you know why John checks through KJPN, right?
Yeah.
Because we were in Pearl Harbor. We've been there a couple times since World War II ended, and every time it's been deluged by Japanese tourists. I mean, you can't get near the place without fighting your way through hordes of Japanese tourists. Now, as a guy who fought in the war, I kind of object to the fact that these guys have taken over Pearl Harbor, and even got a call there at KJPN.
What about noise levels? How would you, I assume, since there are much less stations, a lot less noise? How did you find it?
I would say a lot less noise than we have now, because we didn't have all the electrical equipment we have interfering. We didn't have computers, televisions, anything like that. We didn't have fluorescent lights weren't there, although you didn't have time sensor lights and dimmer switches and all that stuff. But noise is a lot less, and that's why you got such good reception. Noise, is that what you're saying, yeah, David?
Yeah. And what about basically? How would you compare that? Well, you asked your question about the noise levels, but how would you compare, let's say, the challenge of it versus then and now?
Well,
what would you say the most things that you considered, the most things that have changed over the past four decades.
Oh, well, obviously, the huge number of radio stations, we're going from less than 1,000 to 4,700 AM stations, and then all-night stations, we only have maybe two or three dozen in Aurora. And we're now we have every frequency is loaded up with stations. Even in 1964, there was a lot of Monday mornings, everything, but a lot of stuff was clear. So.
Do you hear TAs at all with domestic equipment, nothing special? You didn't need seaside beverages for TAs, I think, the question.
TAs? Do I hear TAs?
No. Back then.
Oh, back then?
Was it more?
The only TAs, I did not get any TAs from Pittsburgh, but I lived there. Not because I couldn't have gotten them, I guess, but because I didn't know what a hat was. And I wasn't really listening at the right time. I didn't realize that they signed off at sunset, about midnight their time, which would be the sunset, and they didn't come on till midnight till 6 or 7 in the morning, so there was a whole evening that was blank. I didn't know how to tune for them. I didn't get any TAs until I got to Philadelphia after the war. But is that what you mean?
Yeah, that's what I meant. Yes.
Yeah.
Ben, I got a final question for you,
and
we're going to have to move along.
Yeah, okay.
When they did that whole swap of frequencies that you were talking about in 1941, that was all really accomplished in one night? Station signed off one night?
It happened all in one day. I'll tell you, there was a lot of confusion. I mean, most listeners, you know, they had to search all over for their favorite program. It was unless you were a listener listening to WIP or something, or WLW, which didn't move, everything was different. Boy, it was a mess. I enjoyed it. you guys would have enjoyed it too. Anything else?
Thank you very much.
A 500 watt daytime only operation when it started. It is now a full-time station on the frequency of 1040 kilohertz. And it has a pending application before the FCC to boost that all the way up to 20,000 watts daytime. In addition, its owner also has some wonderful call letters on his resume like WBBF, WKBW, and CKLW. And rather than me telling you about it, I'm going to let him tell you about it, ladies and gentlemen, Bob Savage.
Well, hi, and thanks, Scott Feibusch. Thanks for the EAS headers. I appreciate that. They're always good listening, you know.
I didn't send an EOM.
Yeah, I'll do that when I'm done here. John Malicki with the flash photography. Glad I brought notes here tonight that I can't see. Well, like most of you guys and ladies in the room tonight, as a young guy, I grew up here in Western New York listening to Top 40 radio, AM radio. Now, I went to school in Livonia, New York, which is Livingston County. That's about 25 miles south of Rochester. And the signals in Rochester meant that listening to AM radio was limited pretty much to daytime because that was 9:50. Hello? These things always make me nervous. We do something like this. Is that better? Is there an RE20 that I could use? Anyway, 950 WBBF and 1370 WSAY were extremely directional, so if I was going to listen to Top 40 music as a kid growing up in Livingston County, south of Rochester, that meant daytime only. If I wanted to stay up on hot music, that meant DXing. Now, in 1965 and 1966, I didn't know that listening to distant radio stations was actually an organized hobby. Like most high schoolers, I just wanted to be cool. So I put up a long wire antenna to enhance reception on my General Electric portable radio, made, by the way, not only in the USA, but made in Utica, New York at the GE plant, which will give you an idea of how old I am. I listened to the biggies, WABC, WLS, WCFL, the Voice of Labor from Chicago, CKLW, and the DXing paved the way for a long career in radio, but we'll get to that story in a minute. Of course, the major source of hit music here in Western New York, if you were growing up in the 1960s, was 50,000 watt WKBW in Buffalo. So for a couple of years, I listened to that odd signal from the Niagara Frontier, you know, the sky wave that beats against the ground wave. You get that phasing, screeching sort of effect. You still get that today between Batavia and Syracuse. And a parenthetical note here, if you had a six-speaker AM stereo rig, back in KB's AM stereo days, it was really psychedelic, because not only would you get the platform effect from left to right, if you had six speakers like I did, it would start to chase around your car in a circular motion. It would get faster and faster, and it would slow down, then it would reverse and go the other way, until finally you got so sick to your stomach you punched the mono button. But anyway, I digress. In listening, I developed an active listen interest in broadcasting, and at age 17, at a daytimer in Hornell, I started a radio career that's at 37 years and counting. LEA. That's right. So let's fast forward a couple of years to November 1969. After jockeying in news at stations in Cornell, Newark, and Binghamton, I landed summer relief at Storrs 50 Kilowatter in Philadelphia, WIBG, and, thank you, on a lark at the beginning of my sophomore year at Ithaca College, I shot off an audition reel to WKBW, Jefferson K., the program director. And much to my surprise, I got a gruff telephone call from Kay 3 days later. Wow. We need a weekender, Savage. If you want it, it's $3 an hour. It can start Saturday night at midnight. I asked if it might not be a good idea for me to come to Buffalo at Mr. Kay's convenience for an interview. And Jeff pulled a great big drag on the camel and said, "That's you on the audition tape, isn't it?" I assured him it was. He said, "Did you lie about anything on your resume?" I said, "Certainly not." He asked, "Is $3 an hour acceptable to you?" Of course, I didn't say so, but I would have worked at KB, the powerhouse rocker of my not yet departed youth, for nothing. So Kay retorted, "I don't see why you should take the time to drive up here, and I don't see why I should take any more time with this. It's midnight to 7, for Christ's sake. If you're any damn good, you might wind up working real hours. We can meet each other then." He hung up. I was hired, I supposed. Saturday night, I arrived in Buffalo 3 hours early. Since I only had about $3 or $4 for the trip, I didn't splurge on the thruway. I drove Route 20 through the November snow from Ithaca, New York. I passed all the great KB advertisers I'd heard about on the radio since the early 1960s. Sattler's 998 Broadway, AM&A's, Your Host Restaurants, Ted's Charcoal Hots. And there in the dumpy digs at 1430 Main Street, the KB Radio Center. Well, after continuous rapping on the plate glass door to the production studio, engineer Norm Bruckner got up from the RCA consulate, let me in, and KB, of course, had that unique smell of radio stations of the 1960s. A mixture of cigarette and cigar smoke, teletype paper, and aging tube-type electronics. I wandered down the narrow hall to the Jock Lounge. It was stacked with papers, records, tapes, promotional displays, assorted junk, but I immediately spied the mailboxes where KB's on-air performers got memos, mail, paychecks, and other important material. And there, on those mailboxes, were the names. Danny Nevereth, Fred Clustine, Stan Roberts, and Bob Savage. What a thrill. There I was, a jittery 19-year-old kid who 2 years ago was listening to these radio gods on the GE in my bedroom. Now I was one of them. Maybe my summertime WIBG coup wasn't a freak accident. I started to think, after 2 years of doing this, maybe my radio career is for real. So I went to the mail slot, labeled Bob Savage, and I found this. Now you see, this is the real item. You remember Ditto machines?
Yeah.
Spirit duplicators, the blue type? As it turns out, it was. Let me read it to you. To all air staff from Jeff K., November 7th, 1969. Subject, scheduled. Gentlemen. No girls at this radio station. We will have some schedule changes effective this weekend. This weekend, Bob Savage, his real name, will be joining the staff. Bob is a student at Ithaca College and has worked summer replacement for Philadelphia's WIBG. If you see him in the halls, don't bother speaking to him or developing any close ties. He may not last. He'll be in tonight to observe the Riley Show. Pat will make him thoroughly uncomfortable and stun him with his prowess on the air. He'll start to work midnight, Saturday night, Sunday morning to 7. Steve Mitchell will sit in with him on this show to break him in. Well, as you can probably imagine, I was dumbfounded. 15 minutes to my shift at this giant radio station. I had no clue what was going to happen. Steve Mitchell, the part-timer who was supposed to train me, hadn't shown up yet, so I walked into the control room to talk to Norm Bruckner, who was slip-queuing a 45 on the RCA transcription turntable. I went to Norm and I said, "What is this, a joke?" So he peered at it after letting go of the record and he says, "Nah, he means it." "That's Jeff. Welcome to KB, kid." "Oh, and by the way, you're not supposed to be in the control room until midnight. This is a NABED area." Well, it's 35 years later, and I'm pleased to tell you that I did last in the business, I guess. Maybe not very long at KB. I did work there twice in 1969 to 1970, then again in 1985. But through radio wars, real wars, technological upheavals, and metamorphoses that would bring any other industry to its knees, if not outright extinction, we're still here. Radio being a dynamic, crazy roller coaster, and it's been an exhilarating ride. My experience at KB on that snowy November night 35 years ago is kind of a metaphor for what's gone on in the radio industry and what continues to go on to this day. Now, time and again, pundits and observers, experts and authorities tell us radio broadcasting as we know it is headed into oblivion. We've been reading our own obituaries now for 50, 60, 70 years. In the 1930s, radio was just a temporary novelty. Newspapers were terrified of radio news, and they tried to kill it in the 1934 press radio war. In World War II, military experts wanted non-essential commercial broadcasting halted so it wouldn't provide radio beacons for enemy attack. The American Federation of Musicians tried to outlaw the playing of recorded music on the radio, which is one reason why today we have the curious phenomenon where broadcasters such as us pay royalties for the privilege of making Frank Sinatra, Elvis, the Beatles, Shania Twain, and Britney Spears multimillionaires. In the 1950s, TV was going to sound the death knell of radio and the movies. In the 1960s, FM was going to kill off AM, the one death notice that came closest to coming true, I have to say. Today, the revenue leader, though, in almost every major market is, you guessed it, the 85-year-old technology of AM radio, even with its inherent noise and narrow bandwidth. The 1970s and 1980s had car stereo proponents and audio freaks predicting that car tape players, 8-tracks, then cassettes, then CDs, were going to shove radio listenership over the cliff. Now the scare is satellite radio. You've all heard the hype, 500 channels, commercial-free, niche formats, and on and on. Never mind that most people are blissfully unaware when they buy satellite radio that they can't get their favorite local stations via satellite. It's true, many new buyers think that satellite radio is analogous to cable TV and that they can use XM or Sirius to improve reception of local radio or listen to stations back home when they're traveling. Like the alleged commercial-free feature, they're in for a shock on these issues. So the predictions of our doom have melted away time after time and over for generations when it comes to the temporal success of radio broadcasting, particularly analog AM radio. Consider that the population of commercial radio stations has exploded from about 800 mostly AM stations after World War II to, last I checked, correct me if I'm wrong on this, about 11,000?
Over
12. Heading for 12. Licensed facilities today. Consider that for comparison, Detroit ran whining to Congress seeking protective tariffs when imports first got 25% penetration of new car sales in the U.S. No other industry, only radio, could not only tolerate an 1,100% increase in competition and survive, but thrive. That's the nature of the dynamic, innovative industry of which we're a part. Which is not to say that radio isn't facing serious challenges. I'm sure that there are many, but three of them occur to me. First one is programming. Now, personally, I'm no prude. I enjoy an off-color, worldly joke as much as anybody, and I'm a vigorous defender of First Amendment protected freedom of expression. Yet at the same time, I strongly believe that the gonzo morning show zoos, the interviews with porn stars and topless dancers are bad for the industry in the long run. And it's not just because in the 1960s, when I entered this business, every station's personality roster was filled with clean-cut, fun-loving guys you could trust with your teenage daughter. at least in the safety of the studio. Remember WKRP's Johnny Fever, who was fired at his previous job for using the word booger on the air? Compare that with an actual program I heard locally of Don and Mike taking a listener poll of which teen star you'd rather have sex with, Christina Aguilera, Britney Spears, or Mandy Moore, after which there was a simulated tour of Britney's alleged breast implants. And this is afternoon drive, when anybody could be listening, kids included. It's just my opinion, funny or not, this kind of stuff doesn't belong on the radio. I don't care what Arbitron says. I remember back when I was riding that school bus in Livonia, the Livonia Central bus driver had rigged up a car radio held on top of the dashboard with twisted copper wires, listening to the hot pop music station, WBBF. Since we were in Livonia, 25 miles south of Rochester, that must have been a heck of a radio. But WBBF, nonetheless, was mass appeal. It was family fair. Kids listened. Housewives listened. Squeaky clean good guy Jerry Fogle. Songs by Nat King Cole as well as Elvis. Reminders to be good citizens. Compare that to today, where actually many school districts are restricting the stations heard on school buses to soft rock or easy listening stations. This isn't prudery. This is prudence. Radio has always made its living through mass appeal, wide-spectrum programming. It's not only an argument about values, it's what's right and wrong, but arithmetic. More listeners or less listeners? Which would you rather have? Sensation and shock do not necessarily equate to good programming, so I wish we could all return to the higher road and get our female and family listeners back. It'll only happen when corporate programmers take a longer view, not just the frenetic, "This rating book's got to be better than the last one." Short-term objective. Let's put some class back on the radio. The related programming issue I want to bring up tonight is localism. A major radio group in recent years has come up with a concept of branding, analogous to chain restaurants. So like the predictable sameness of McDonald's hamburgers, when you tune in The Mix or The Kiss or The Zone or whatever, in any city, you always get the same product. Voice tracking. Where the midday jock in L.A. is the evening voice of Shreveport, and the afternoon drive guy in Boise is a corollary of this. My reaction is, just because it's possible to do this technically and it makes sense economically, doesn't automatically make it a good idea for the listener and for the industry. Radio's always had its roots in localism. It's one very effective tool against satellite formats that we should not abandon. Challenge number two, technology and propagation. Today, led by industry magazines and newspapers that are largely supported by equipment manufacturers, there is a headlong rush into digital broadcasting. IBOC. Ask me about IBOC. Boy.
We were warned about this.
I'm always in favor of anything that will improve our product and increase listenership and revenue. It is disturbing, however, to hear the crescendo of reports from the field about the actual performance of Ubiquiti's in-band on-channel system, particularly with regard to AM. Just one example, Radio Management Report had an August article that said AM IBOC in major markets where the band is crowded in its current form is going to create a cacophony of adjacent channel noise. Examples were cited in Washington, D.C. and New York City, where the IBOC-equipped AMs were throwing noise 30 and 40 kilohertz up and down the band. Obliterating adjacent channel reception, WOR, absolutely. These stations were using supposedly IBOC-capable recent generation transmitters and Ubiquiti exciters. The issue, ladies and gentlemen, always comes back to the listeners. The listener doesn't care that they're using the latest technology. They want to get the news. They want to hear Rush. They want to get the traffic report, find out who won the game last night. Without objectionable amounts of fiddling or adjusting, and with reasonably acceptable fidelity. If the listener has to tune through a wall of adjacent channel noise or put up with annoying mode hopping between digital and analog, they're just going to do the expedient thing. They're going to push the FM button. Or they'll turn the radio off, and neither of these are good things for AM. It's just my personal observation that AM radio consumers are not there for the sound quality anyway. If you need proof, consider the average plastic clock radio or car radio with 20% IM and 3 kilohertz bandpass. AM radio is a success because it's a precisely marketed product appropriate for its application, a convenient, useful product like the Coke machine on the corner. It may not dispense Cabernet or chilled mineral water or Jack Daniels, but it serves a singular purpose well. Like I said, I'm all for progress so long as it's well-considered and thought out. But I do get concerned when I hear phrases in the trades about how Ubiquiti's IBOC AM will create an acceptable level of adjacent channel noise, or how skywave listening is archaic anyway, and nighttime interference is predicted to be minimal. It's my view that any loss of listenership, groundwave, skywave, local, distant, is unacceptable.
Amen.
The IBOC system ultimately adopted should not make analog listening obsolete. It should represent no loss from the current status quo. Ubiquiti should re-engineer the system to eliminate the apparent defects which are being manifested in field tests. For our part, broadcasters should resist being stampeded by trade magazines dependent on equipment manufacturers. Now, the third challenge I see is personnel. 30 years ago, the lowest level of the radio farm system, like in baseball, was the training ground where all veteran broadcasters have learned the ropes. This was true for me, for Randy Michaels, for Rush Limbaugh, the Grease Man, and Clark Ingram, too. In every town of 5,000 people or more, there's a little local coffee pot there, perched over the drugstore or in a storefront, a daytimer or a little AM-FM combo. Two or three full-timers there, a couple of high school kids jocking or doing news, and generally, at least one of them had some talent. They provided the human fodder that today populates major radio groups, networks, and other positions of leadership in our industry. Well, economics and technology have changed all this. Small stations today program with satellite-delivered formats or hard drive systems bought off the shelf. Now, granted, it sounds better than some farm kid making a stupid comment between a couple of records, but the downside is there's no new talent in the pipeline. Just try hiring somebody today. I honestly don't have the answer to this one, but as an industry, we better start giving this our attention. Sad to say that Danny Nevereth and Bob Savage are not going to live together, even though probably Jack Boga will. It may be appropriate for industry groups to address this in partnership with higher education, colleges like Ithaca or Fredonia with broadcasting curricula, maybe the NAB, maybe the NRC could provide grants to junior achievement chapters to encourage new interest in broadcasting as a career, with a special emphasis on practical field experience. Most aspects of radio broadcasting, from on-air to news, to sales to engineering, are best learned by doing. They don't lend themselves well to classroom training. And again, we should brainstorm the personnel drought and start investing in the people who will pilot this industry after we're all gone. We don't want to be known as the industry that ate its young. So those are some thoughts about radio, the past, the future, some aspects of our vital industry, which has attracted all of us here tonight. Scott Feibusch wanted me to talk a little bit about what we do at WYSL and why we do it, so I'll do that briefly. After years of doing everything in radio, from engineering to on-air to legal, for other employers, I discovered a certain sameness to the routine. And at the ripe old age of 36, bear in mind that I started on my 17th birthday, in preference to working for others, I obeyed the old maxim, if I have to work for a jerk, it might as well be me. I filed for and received a CP for the AM Daytimer in Avon, New York, which became WYSL in 1986 on 1030. The strategy here, why did I apply for a daytimer in 1986? Well, the strategy was to get a preference for an FM channel, which the commission had also assigned to Avon. As we waited for the filing window to open for 93.3, we also petitioned for a nearby FM as a first audio service in Honeoye Falls to be added on 107.3, and ultimately we won both construction permits, although we did settle out on Honeoye Falls. In 1996, we sold 93.3 to Heritage. It's now Intercom's WBBF, having moved its city of license north to Fairport, and, of course, 107.3 is Clear Channel's modern rocker, The Nerve. The history of WYSL was 500 watts, non-DN 1030, for the first 8 months of operation. We filed for an increase to a kilowatt the day after we went on the air, which was a strategy to keep WBZ from petitioning to keep us from starting up. From October 1987 to November 1997, we were 1,000 watts daytime. Of necessity, this was a pretty limited facility, not very competitive, so in the early 90s, we started looking for ways to upgrade that. The research revealed choices of either 580 or 1040. At the time, it looked like 580 would be too directional because of WSYR to the east, so we went for 1040, and we got DA2, 2,500 day, two towers, 500 night, four towers on 1040. This CP was issued in 1994. We built it in 1997. We moved to 1040 pursuant to an STA in August of 1997 using 625 watts non-D. The DA proof went out in the fall of 97, and in late December, we received program test authority for full-time operation, and we started our current facility on the last day of 1997. In January of this year, as Scott has mentioned, we applied for 20 kW day, 13.2 kW critical hours using all four towers, so ultimately we'll be at DA3, and that CP application is pending. We also did a pre-filing in the new facility window for 1220, 2.5 kW DA1 or 2, we haven't decided which yet. That'll be diplex on our current array, and we intend to file for that when the commission green lights it. We're currently at WYSL News. The format's built around Associated Press All News Radio, and a professional, as opposed to a legal partnership with WHEC-TV, the NBC affiliate in Rochester. We're a major player in local sports. We're the voice of Rhinos soccer, Red Wings baseball, and tons of local collegiate sports, including the University of Rochester, St. John Fisher, Nazareth, and Roberts Wesleyan Colleges. We also do select sports broadcasts for RIT, MCC, and SUNY Geneseo. We have a small but dedicated and extremely talented staff, including station manager and play-by-play voice J.C. DeLasse, operations manager Bob D'Angelo, Mark Hillman, and Joe Santani. We have no formal sales department at WYSL. We all sell and service our clients. Our advertisers sometimes call us at home or in the car if they have needs. Many are personal friends who come to our home on Kinesis Lake for cookouts and other family events. We have many, many associates and friends from advertisers to vendors and suppliers and non-affiliated friends like Scott. And we're thankful for all these great relationships. But I just want to especially acknowledge somebody tonight, the person who really keeps WYSL and me cooking, my wife and partner, Judith Day, to whom we owe the success and smooth operation of the station. I'd like to recognize Judith tonight. WYSL runs unattended for weekend and night hours. We're fully automated where needed, both in terms of programming and technical aspects. Having a compact operation of this nature has been likened to having a perpetual six-month-old that always needs you and never shuts up. Whenever we're out in the dead of winter, chipping ice out of a tower-based spark gap, or wrestling with some car dealer who wants to grind you for $2 commercials, all I have to do is remember the stories I hear from my friends in Major Market Group Radio. And I feel thankful all over again for the choice I made 19 years ago to do this on our own. Now, running your own station isn't easy. It's certainly not for everyone. You've got to have good soldering skills. The ego has to be kept on a short leash. Humility level as high as you can stand. But at the end of the day, we lock the door and take a look at those four towers in our beautiful 14-acre facility, and we think about the call we got from that advertiser who said WYSL made his used car tent sale a huge success. We remember the calls we got about the ball game or the out-of-town parents or the college quarterback listening all about their son on our live internet stream. We think about our 9/11 coverage or the special news events and snowstorms and power failures and how we touch the lives of people in our service area. We recall the DX reports we get from Ohio and Virginia and Toronto and, believe me, about a dozen from Finland. In short, creating your own radio station is the closest thing you'll come to making an inanimate thing into a living, growing, evolving being. So we may have unleashed a loudmouthed Frankenstein, but we wouldn't have it any other way. All right, thank you very much, Judith, and I invite you to stop by, tour WYSL if you're in Avon, New York. If you can't, you can listen to us on the web at WYSL1040.com. I thank you for the chance to come here and talk radio with fellow radio geeks. Best wishes, good listening, be big, be a builder.
Well, I think the first order of business ought to be to give a big hand again to our host, who tonight have brought us fabulous speakers, and John and Linda for helping with the registrations and anybody else who had anything to do with it. I talked to Ken a couple of nights ago, Ken Chatterton, the chairman of the board of directors. He said the club is alive and well, and we've known that. He said he started mailing out the new logbooks, I think on Tuesday or Wednesday, so if you pre-ordered, you might go home and find a logbook in your mailbox. Bernie, I think you've got a presentation to make. Come on down. And then I've got one more thing to bring across.
Well, thank you, Paul. This is about the only time I get to be on the camera, not even from behind it. But anyway, every year, the club gives a plaque to who the board thinks is the most worthy of helping out with the club. There's somebody in this room that did a lot of work for the club in the past, years ago. So I would like the gentleman in the second row from the back with a blue shirt, John Kellerman. Come on. John, the board of directors want to present this to you for their appreciation of your work in the early days of the club.
Well, thank you, Ernie, and thanks to the all the club members. And it does this old has-been's heart good to get this from the group of people that I have loved so much for so long. Thank you.
John?
As one of the publishers of the magazines of the National Radio Club, I'd like to thank Scott Feibusch and his bunch for putting on an absolute fantastic convention. Well, to start off our business meeting, I'd like to introduce to you a gentleman. Ken Chatterton has been our general manager of the National Radio Club for, it seems like a long time. In fact, some people have accused Ken of being so old that he knew Jesus when they were on the same basketball team together in high school. Ken's been a longtime member and a real good friend. I'd like to introduce him at this time to head up our business meeting. Ken Chatterton.
Well, thank you all. And thank you for being here. To start off, I would like to announce that our financial situation is still very, very good. Our accounting system counts all subscriptions as being a liability. We have a positive balance, that means that if for some reason we should suddenly close today, all of you would get your unused subscription money back.
Right.
And there are several clubs that I don't think can say that. Now, we need bids for the next convention. So we'll be looking for those. If you think you want a bid, let us know. And we'll have information for you on what it takes to host a convention. And now, we ordinarily, every year, we award a plaque to someone who has done a great deal for the club, and this year will be no exception. This year I would like to introduce Ernie Wesolowski, who will make the presentation, and I believe that this presentation is a complete surprise.
We have two people facing you in the front of the room by the name of Linda and John Bowker. Would you like to say a few words, John?
No, here.
You are.
Unaccustomed as I am. This was a total surprise, and we're most appreciative. Linda's been doing this reception work, sort of, for what, 10 years now? And we thoroughly enjoy working and being with all of you. So thank you very much, Ken and Ernie.
Can we have Linda read it?
In appreciation of service to DX News and the DX Audio Service for their hours and miles in producing the travelogue, we salute John and Linda Bowker, Batavia, New York, September 2004.
My 30-second story, the first night I was on the air was at WHWH in Princeton, and I, too, started at midnight on Saturday, the prime time. They weren't sure of us. And I had Linda sitting there, and the very first time after the ABC News at midnight, I came on and I said, and here's the weather. I didn't have the weather. And Linda was right there beside me, and she said, it's going to rain. And she said this on the microphone. And I thought, she isn't supposed to do that. And I said, how do you know it's going to rain? And she said, because the Big Dipper is tipped over. That's true. That's it. We were the hit of Nassau County in New Jersey. It did rain. It started raining about 2:30 that morning. So Linda is the broadcaster of the family, I can tell. Hey, thanks again.
And that's All Radio, Volume 2 on this edition. Until next time, 73 and good DX.